Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday morning. It's the 16th of January. Very nice to have you with us. We are hearing a little bit of the Cranberries this morning. Their lead singer, Dolores O'Riordan, passed away over the weekend. She was 46 years old, and so we'll be playing some of the music, some acoustic versions from an album that came out last year called Something Else, and it's beautiful. You know, I always loved her voice. Because you could actually hear the Irish in it. Sometimes, whether it be English or Irish, it sometimes goes away in the singing, and it's so beautiful and Gaelic. So we lost her over the weekend, actually, and so we'll be playing some acoustic versions from the Cranberries this morning. All right, welcome to the program. Very nice to have you with us. Let me introduce everybody to you, and then we'll get started and talk about what's going on in our world as it stands right now. And everything's going great. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a communications consultant, and we are lucky to have her today. And I thank you very much for coming in the weather and making your way in. I appreciate it.
Just so delighted to be here. An extra day this week.
Thank you very much. Nice to have you here. JP Miller is with us as well.
Good to be on with JP. I'm
yes.
so excited.
Good morning, Teresa. Good morning, Joe.
He is the man behind the founder of the Empire Report, and it's a very successful news aggregator. It is a Bible for all of us in journalism and for anyone who lives in this state. And you're doing well, right?
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Yeah, good to have you with us. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan.
JP and I were sitting in the office, and he saw Mario's picture with me from 1984 up on the wall. And we had this conversation. I got emotional talking about the day that Mario came to the fund drive to do the last Capital Connection. He had lost, and he was not going to come out of the. He was not going to come out of the mansion. And Roselle said, "He's coming." And the volunteers were all there, and they all stood up, and they were crying, and they were applauding. And he gave the most poignant program you have ever heard in your whole life. And then he got up and he waved to the group. It was such an extraordinary talk that he gave that day. And I walked him out to the door, and then I came back, and Dave Gillette was there, and we started to argue just with our fingers about how much we were going to charge for that tape. So much for the Mario, for Mario's, you know, last tape on the show. And he did something he'd never done before. He hugged me before he walked out. And then I said, okay, so it's $50 if you want Mario's monumental tape. And one phone rang at one end of the room, and then another phone rang at the other end of the room, and then every single phone went off, and for 7 hours they rang.
People knew it was something special.
Oh, yeah, and that was the end. That was the end of the fund drive. In other words, it was the first and only fund drive, one-day fund drive, up to that point.
Can you imagine what right now if his voice, you know, I think recently if we had Senator Kennedy's voice in the mix of what's
sure.
going on, and I wonder too if
sure.
what would Mario Cuomo say to him?
Oh yeah. So,
you know,
so it was just the most unbelievable moment, and people would not, they had to go to the bathroom, but they would not give up their seats because they knew somebody else would sit down at their phone, mm-hmm. and they wanted to be there for that historic moment. And it was really something. And Roselle had said, "I'm coming over. He's going to come." And I said, "No, they've already told me he's not going to show up." And she said, "No, I'm coming over." And sure enough, as always, she knew what she was talking about. And he showed up.
He understood the power and the importance of the station and communicating with his constituents.
Well, he may have, but, you know, I just always thought that it was more of an emotional, you know.
But having that, don't you think having that conversation,
yeah,
it's kind of like
it was
the
something.
Fireside chats at Roosevelt, you know.
Oh, yeah. You know, I said to him, Teresa, I said to him, you know, are you depressed about this? I knew he was, but I said, "Are you depressed?" And he started talking about his brother who had lost a child, who would, I think, fallen in a pool outside the house. He said, that's a reason for depression. Serving the people of New York was, you know, it was anything but that. It was just, anyway, I just thought I'd tell a little of that story then, just a little bit. That tape's always available, anybody wants it.
We welcome your letters this morning, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A reminder, we just have a few tickets left, and I think it's under 20, the number of tickets we have left for the event across the street. And that is on Friday, so 3 days from now, right? Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, yes. So that will commemorate the one-year anniversary of the Trump administration, and our panel all-stars, including all four of us in this room. And a lot of other folks will be with us, and we'll be going from 9 to 11. Plus, we'll be serving breakfast at 8:15. And we started off with 200 tickets, and we're down to the dregs, down to the last 20.
Yeah.
And so
the last special ones left.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely.
But you know, Joe, what I'm really thinking of here is how important the symbolism of not only the Mario story I told you and what a station is and how we were all together on that, but JP was somewhat amazed to hear that every public radio station in New York and in Boston, by the way, played the Capitol Connection in those days every week. And it lasted for 18 years. It was an incredible run.
That's how he communicated. Yeah.
But what a spirit of WAMC it was, and what a spirit, Joe, talking about the first year of Trump, and we've all been. Not, if not traumatized, Trumpicized for this year, but we're all been together, and we're going to talk about that. And that makes this radio station so special. So if there's 20 left, let me tell you, 1-800-323-9262. Don't be calling me up and saying later on, hey, can't you get me into this incredibly special thing? There's only 20. Look, they're gone. They're going to be gone. There's only 20 left. I'm not concerned about the tickets. I'm concerned about the station. And if you love this station, and if you loved it back to Mario, and if you love it now, and that we're all here at this traumatic time when this country is going through hell together, and where else do you have a panel like this one? Nowhere.
Or the conversation like Joe had with Khazir Khan, which is just stunning,
exactly,
I think.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or you with Richie Neal or Chris Senator Murphy or those folks, too.
Well,
I think are invaluable for people to have an understanding of their democracy.
And the ability to have the whole audience there for a live taping sounds like a lot of fun. It's going to be my first. I'm really looking forward to being there.
That's great. Yeah, it's all live. So whatever we say, it goes right out. And I'm saying that more as a reminder.
I said something in my office this morning, which I'm just glad the tape recorder wasn't running.
Okay, we'll leave it there. good morning. Let's get to the topics. Again, WAMC.org if you want to help us out and you want a ticket to the broadcast and help out the Tower Fund as well as the lockbox for the fund drive, which begins on February 5th. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262.
Joe, I know I keep interrupting, and I'm sorry for that, but it's not only the last 20 tickets to this thing. We're almost whole. We're almost there. We've almost got $1 million in the lockbox. We got, what, 900 and, do you remember what it was?
You're right. It's
940,
something like that.
46. So we're almost at $1 million. And, you know, those 20 tickets, they'll help, all right. But what will really help is if everybody in parts of six states who have just purchased the tower together put something in and say, we want to be part of this right now. We could be at that million right this moment.
WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. All right, let's go to what is happening and the things making news. And we go to the talk about shutdown. And this is rising, and Trump's immigration words apparently still posing risks for both parties, according to an article in the New York Times. And it is got a lot of people on edge, and the talk about shutdown is seeming to be more and more intense and perhaps even more probable as we get closer. It is Tuesday. We have a lot of work to get done before Friday. The question, of course, is DACA and the immigration talk. So a lot going on there. And meanwhile, in the course of all this, you still have the denials and the sort of the spectacle of all of that. But while all of this is going on, tick-tock. Alan, what do you think?
Well, look, Mike Pence walked into an African-American church yesterday on the occasion of Martin Luther King's birthday, and the African-American preacher stood up and really let loose and said, you know, if anyone has said this, and it was clearly referring to Trump, although he didn't say his name, and there was Pence, apparently, people around him said his face had gotten red. There is the right thing here. Lindsey Graham, of all people, stood up yesterday and said 80% of the American people, 80% believe those kids, those DACA kids, should have a chance. 80%. And 80% thinks we should, and he just said, and 80% think our immigration laws ought to be fixed and America ought to be protected. But Lindsey Graham, of all people, said 80% of this country are doing basically the right thing. They care about those kids. And I think, you know, no matter how much this guy plays to his base, and apparently with all his nonsense, I never said it, I may have said instead of asshole, I may have said as something else. With all that nonsense, he was caught bragging, and people have testified to this now, saying, you know, this is good for my base. My base likes this. This was his rationale. What a human being, or a lack of a human being, we have sitting there. So the DACA thing, how do you turn around and say to 80% of the people of this country, I think DACA should be dead if you don't give me the stupid wall. It does not speak well of us or anything else.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really tough for them to pass DACA. You have Democrats are far away from Republicans on this issue, and it's an issue where I think that they have to get 60 votes in the Senate to pass. And you would think that with an impending issue like this that's on the top of everyone's mind, both Trump voters and anti-Trump voters, everybody realizes that there's a huge need to fix the immigration problem in this country, especially these DACA kids. And you're right, the clock is ticking, and it's hard to see these two sides coming together to hammer out a deal with the way things stand now.
And one of the things that's not getting much attention is the actual substance of the spending bill that they're trying to pass. I mean, the key to the government shutdown is that they need to pass a budget or a continuing resolution. And there is such internal division within the Republican Party, not just over immigration, there certainly is that, but there's also deep fissures around what the budget priority should be. Some want more military spending, but you've just passed this big tax bill, so there isn't enough funding for that. And some, you know, the Democrats say, well, if you're going to, you know, there has to be parity between domestic and military spending. And their whole group of Republicans who want deep cuts in Medicaid and Medicare, and they wanted to start with this budget bill. So now, just 4 days to go, there's been no public airing of those kinds of issues, and they can't reach internal agreement. And it appears what they're trying to do is craft a short-term, what they call a continuing resolution. So yet CO. Again, so you have the Republicans in charge of the White House, the House and the Senate, yet they still aren't capable of doing the basic functions of government, which is passing a budget. Now, thankfully, they aren't able to do that, because I think any budget that they could get through would probably be quite draconian, unless they take the step of pairing, you know, putting aside the Freedom Caucus and pairing with Democrats and passing a more reasonable budget.
I was going to ask you, Teresa, about the Freedom Caucus, because apparently Trump gives tremendous deference to those far-right guys who are sitting down there in the corner and tell them, you know, your constituency, our constituency, would not put up with this if you were to give those DACA kids their chance.
Right. Well, in the past, the Freedom Caucus has been somewhat marginalized, but with Trump, you know, Bannon, this is the Bannon Caucus, this is the Stephen Miller Caucus, and this is what I mentioned yesterday. Well, all the focus on that famous meeting, infamous meeting now, has been on what was said or wasn't said, and reports out today is it was the breadth of a meeting was breathtakingly vulgar, not just one or two comments. But to me, the most important thing that happened in that meeting is that previously Trump, in the meeting that was televised, said, you know, you bring me a compromise, Republicans, Democrats, get together, bring me a compromise. You know, the Republicans and Democrats went away. They did that. They came back with a compromise. Well, Stephen Miller and the Pence wing of the White House heard that they were coming up, that Durbin and some of the Republicans were coming up with a compromise. And they, you know, dialed up really quickly the Freedom Caucus folks on the House side and the ultra-conservatives on the Senate side and brought them up for the meeting.
We'll pause there. We will continue when we come back. We are going to take a news break, and when we return, we'll talk more about this and include your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. It's the 16th of January. We have some letters. Alan will read those, and then we'll move on to some other topics and see what other trouble we can get into in an hour.
Okay. So, good morning, panel.
Good morning.
If patronage of hookers got Elliot Spitzer out of office as governor of New York, it should be good enough reason, in addition to many other reasons, to remove Donald Trump from the presidency. The alternatives to his resignation will be another period of interminable months of uncertainty as Watergate. Much worse than Nixon, the current president is increasingly irrelevant, leading to a great loss of credibility of the United States internationally, but he is powerful, unpredictable, and downright dangerous. A constitutional crisis worse than Watergate is imminent. Kevin says, can the Democrats lobby to bring a bill to the floor for a DACA vote? I'm assuming a straight up or down vote would probably have enough to pass. Putting the pressure on Republicans and using the legislative process could back Republicans into a corner, put it to a vote, or look real bad. Teresa, would you like to talk a little bit about the legislative process and the power of the speaker?
Right. So they don't have the ability to force a vote on the floor. If the DACA bill did come to the floor today, up or down vote, forced a vote just on a clean bill on these kids, it would pass. And that's why Ryan is keeping it off. But in fact, what the Democrats are trying to do right now is leverage the need for Democratic support to pass a spending bill or a continuing resolution to force the this DACA bill through as clean a DACA bill as possible, and then handle the other complex issues of immigration separately.
Yes. Just as a political science aside, you can, of course, force a vote on any bill.
Well, we forced a vote on, the minimum wage many years ago.
And on the civil rights bill.
Right.
It's called a discharge petition, and it takes 218 signatures. The discharge petition is put on the speaker's desk, and everybody comes up, and the speaker doesn't have to tell you when you have 218. The way that it worked in the civil rights bill, I was there at the time, is they held back a whole bunch of Democrats. They knew they had them, but the speaker wasn't releasing it. They sent people up, and they would each memorize 10 people who were on the discharge petition, and then they leaked the whole thing to the New York Times, and all the liars who said that they had signed who hadn't had to sign, and that's how it got through. But discharges. Petitions don't really happen that often.
Right. Very, very difficult. Well, on the Senate side, there's what they call legislative tree. And for months, one of Senator Kennedy's people sat on the Senate floor just waiting and watching for them to make a mistake on the filling up what's called the tree, the amendment tree. And finally, there was an opening, and he got the forced the minimum wage bill as a vote, as an amendment, and what's called an amendment to a very complex legislative chicanery. It wasn't chicanery, it was process, but forced to vote, and then they had to raise the minimum wage. Because yeah. we knew if it ever went to an up or down vote, people would vote for it.
Yeah. But
drove Bob Dole out of the Senate when he was running for election. He left early.
Keith says...
That's arcane, boy. Sorry. Sorry, that was way deep in the weeds.
Well, it is, but it's so important to know that if you know what you're doing, that the people who know what they're doing, it makes all the difference in the world.
Right.
Adam Clayton Powell, the late Adam Clayton Powell, the Powell Amendment, right. Which in fact meant you couldn't give any money to any school district if they were practicing any kind of, segregationist stuff. Anyway, Keith says, the president is a racist. A racist is enforcing Americans' policies. The president is a racist. A racist is making and enforcing policies for America. He has signed orders to remove over 1 million people of color from the U.S., making America whiter. Shut this government down. This government doesn't deserve to be open. It's a moral imperative to vote and replace this government in November. And by the way, Keith, I think you're onto something here, because I truly believe that the 2018 election for both houses, for the Senate, where the Democrats have to defend an awful lot of seats, and for the House, which it looks like more and more they might be able to take, the key is going to be, the implicit key is going to be, if you vote for a Democrat, they will vote to impeach Trump. I'm sure that is going to be. They may not say, Congressman, are you going to vote to beat him? I can't talk about it at this time, but he certainly has done many very, very bad things. Well, it's clear that will be the approach in the 2018 election.
I'm not sure, though, that the Democrats are that excited about shutting down the government. They see Trump as, even though they disagree with him on policy, they see him as a very effective political messenger. He's excellent at blaming others for his own problems. And if they do shut down the government, he will be on Twitter. He will be blaming them and saying this is their problem. This is what they did. And I don't think they're excited to do that. And on impeachment, certainly, this will be a huge referendum, the 2018 midterms, on the performance of President Trump. And we have very exciting for us in New York. We have a number of very competitive congressional seats in the state, both upstate and downstate, for which... the balance of power in Congress will depend on how these incumbent Republican members of Congress do in their own elections.
And, you talk about the Democrats and worried about Trump, but also the Democrats for years and years have held it in their pocket that they were the party that did not shut down the government and sort of running on that principle. So it would be tough for them to then turn around and allow that. Without a pretty good fight.
Well, I'm sorry, Teresa, let me disagree with both of you, because I do think that the party in power gets the responsibility for passing a budget or passing a continuing resolution, as Teresa has said. It has never been the party out of power which gets the blame. Now, JP is absolutely right. Trump is trying to message this as the Democrats' fault. And if the Democrats can't answer effectively, you would be right, JP. And right now, Trump and his Twittering, get an awful lot of attention.
And what Trump is already beginning to do, you saw it over the weekend, is to blame the Democrats. But in fact, it's the Republicans whose internal division within the Republicans is preventing them from putting together a budget deal that they can pass without Democratic support. That's the problem. They do not have enough internal coherence to put together a budget package that they can get enough votes for.
Right.
Go ahead, JP.
Well, on the budget, I think that last year that they passed a $4 trillion budget, and these Republicans are supposed to be, they're elected to be fiscal conservatives, and the budgets that they're passing are increasing spending in every part of government. People talk about there are going to be cuts to government. Well, they're not cuts. They're just reductions in the increase. And so they have had to rely on Democratic votes, and Trump is in a little bit of a pickle because he relied on Democratic votes to past the first either one or two continuing resolutions.
But they have an added strain, though, and Alan, just quickly, their added strain is that they pass this tax bill. And so now they have a lot less money to work with, and they have problems. And they also now have governors, Republican governors up for election, and they've put these governors in very tight budgetary straits.
Well, my answer to that would be, you're right, Teresa, as always. And you're right.
But.
No, you're absolutely right in terms of emphasizing what's in the weeds, how this thing really works. But if you don't keep it simple, if you don't have a real simple message, you lose. So as JP says, and as you've said, Trump is out there tweeting like crazy. Now, it's the Democrats' fault. It's the Democrats' fault. It's the Democrats' fault. That's the big lie. JP was telling me something, and I'm going to be somewhat self-serving now, earlier today, which was that when he put my column up this week about Gillibrand being a grave danger to Andrew Cuomo getting the presidential nomination, because he really can't beat up on Gillibrand the way he does on de Blasio, the mayor of New York, because he would look like the bully that some people think that he is. Well, apparently, according to JP, my column got tremendous numbers of clicks on it because it was a very simple column, a very simple message. He's got a big problem here. You're right, Teresa, about everything you've just said. But if the people don't know it, if they listening to a big bully saying again and again, it's the Democrats' fault, it's the Democrats, it's propaganda 101. And you as a communications expert know that more than anybody.
That's why the Democrats need a clear message of what are the priorities, whose side are you on? That's, you know, what do you value? Do you value a border wall that all the experts say we don't need? Well, the equivalent. They're proposing to cut, say it again. They asking $16 billion for the border wall. They want to cut about $16 billion from the Health and Human Services budget. Health and Human Services budget is Medicare and Medicaid. It's the food and drug, food safety. It's Center for Disease Control. It's research for new discoveries in brain science and all sorts of health issues. So what are your priorities? Whose side do you want? That's really, it is and always has been the fundamental issue. So instead of talking about what vulgar thing Donald Trump said in a meeting, we know he's vulgar, we know his, whatever, let's talk about whose side are you on? What are budgetary priorities?
I want to say there was one more letter, and I can't find it right now on my device here. But it did say, I had told the story about Mario Cuomo back in the day, and it did say, no, he went after the teachers. No, that was Andrew. That was Andrew Cuomo, not Mario Cuomo.
Yeah. So on those budget priorities, what I think Trump is going to say is we have a $4 trillion budget. $16 billion out of a $4 trillion budget is like, a drop in a bucket.
When you're cutting $16 billion from, I'm interrupting you.
I understand. They're cutting, when you say cut, they're reducing the increase to the Health and Human Services budget, but not
the FDA and not Health and not the Centers for Disease Control. Those are 31% cut, not cutting the increase, cutting the budget.
I don't think they're with a $4 trillion budget that they're passing, which is greater than the budgets that Barack Obama passed. I can't imagine that they're cutting any part of the government, but maybe they are. But on the wall, you look at Trump. The wall and immigration was his number one issue, and it's more than a policy issue. It's really a cultural issue for what's happening in America, and he wants his base, but he also looks at not just his base, but he looks at a majority of people in Florida. Where he won, a majority of people in Michigan and Pennsylvania. He was the first Republican to win those states in a generation. He won Ohio by 8 points, and he ran on a border wall that was supposed to be paid for by Mexico.
He said, build a wall and
it was going to be paid for by Mexico, but he wants to deliver on the wall.
Delivering on his campaign promise means he builds a wall, and who pays for it?
Mexico.
So why $16 billion to the American taxpayers? That's not delivering on his promise.
He would rather explain away the $16 billion than have to go to people and say, I wasn't able to build the wall. I wasn't able to deliver on that promise of building the wall. He thinks that getting the wall started will help him get reelected. That's his only motivation, is getting reelected. He doesn't care about what's right or what's compassionate. All he cares about is getting reelected.
Okay, so Bob, I know we have to go to a break, but Bob writes a letter and he says, good morning, panel. Trump rages almost daily against Democrats while we Dems wait in vain for a strong Democratic voice to respond. Isn't that supposed to be Schumer's job if the minority leader isn't up to it? Maybe it's time for new leadership. Any thoughts on who that could be? And Bob, while you and I don't always agree in your letter writing, I have to say, I do think it's a question, Teresa and group of messaging. Teresa, you're right about everything you say, but if you can't keep it simple and you can't make a compelling argument and compete with Trump on this stuff, you lose.
Well, let the American people raise their voices. It helped doing health care.
Yeah. All right, we have to go to a break. Let's do that, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on the 16th of January. We have some letters. We'll go there, and then we'll see how much we can get to and other stuff before we go to a break at the top of the hour.
R. Jeremy says, we've lost the immigration argument. We're being defined by the Republicans who twist our support for immigrants into implying we want more immigrants, a position that only 15% of the people support Pew Research. As Alan, the political scientist, knows, to be a nation, you need to be in control of your borders. We need to say this without apology. I've always said it. And I said it earlier in this program that the American people want the immigration thing done, but they also want kids to have the DACA kids to have their say. And that's 80% of Americans.
You orderly and fair.
What'd you say?
Orderly and fair.
Yep. Okay. And Henry says, the important takeaway of Senator Graham's remark about 80% of Americans supporting DACA was that he said twice, Mr. President, you need to take action, indicating that Republicans will not support Trump's inevitable cries of Democratic obstructionism. Mike says, commentators make a big deal out of statements from Lindsey Graham. They imply he's against President Trump and his policies. Likewise, whenever the senators Flake, Corker, et cetera, make bold anti-Trump noises, they're heralded as moral Republicans. But their voting records belie this. They all voted to repeal the ACA and to impose new tax bill that favors the rich. The old adage, actions speak louder than words, applies here, and that's Mike from Saratoga Springs.
I agree with Mike from Saratoga Springs in that I saw Lindsey Graham on Meet the Press the other week, and he was saying a lot of positive things about Trump, and what it's allowing him to be is a little bit of an umpire on Trump, where he gets he's going to be a cheerleader for him. He's going to agree with him on a lot of issues, but when something big comes up like this and Trump's kind of shirking responsibility and not coming through on what he says he is, he's going to call the president on it, and I think it gives him a little bit more of gravitas with the news media and with voters, because he's not seen as simply an anti-Trump person.
I agree with every word you just said.
And to reinforce that, there was an interesting interview last night. Amanpour, Christiane Amanpour, has a show now with Charlie Rose gone. She's filled that slot. She's tremendous. But with Senator Flake. And he was, very hard on Trump. And then she called him on, well, but you voted with him on X percentage of the time. And he said, there's a difference between, he said, I've come to this with my own philosophical beliefs. I'm very, very conservative. In some cases, my beliefs align with Trump's, and I will continue to vote my beliefs. But separately is Trump's behavior, and he's going to speak out about his behavior. But he said, I'm not going to change my political beliefs just because of Trump's abhorrent behavior. He didn't use the word abhorrent, but essentially that's what he's saying.
Peter says, panel, when was the last time Congress passed a bill that was supported by the majority of the electorate.
I'm trying to think. There were a couple of bipartisan bills that they passed this year, and I'd have to do a quick Google search, which I can't. But there have been some. Certainly, Child Health Plus, if they could only pass it now, that has long had bipartisan support.
Kathleen says, impeach? We can't impeach Trump because Pence is waiting in the weeds to pounce. He wants the scenario to happen as he can consolidate his religious extremist ideology in the White House and the Supreme Court. I firmly believe this would be worse. Pence could probably get reelected. Keep up the great work. That's from Kathleen. My intuition is if Trump is thrown out, and especially if Pence has to pardon him, as Ford had to pardon Nixon, he's done.
But is he complicit with what was going on?
Absolutely.
Yeah, there is that.
I think if Trump gets impeached, both parties win. The Democrats get rid of Trump, and the Republicans get a kind of a reasonable president to work with to maybe pass some legislation. Everybody wins.
There'll be an awful lot of people who scream, yell, and are banging on their radios right now who say he is that Pence is not a reasonable kind of Republican.
Well, more reasonable than Trump, right?
Well, more emotionally.
Well, without the tweeting, without the Twitter account.
But the last letter indicates that he could be quite dangerous. In terms of, the religious ideology and the rest of it. So
he's a real deal hardcore conservative.
Hardcore, right wing. And I think what he's doing is adeptly using the chaos presidency that is Trump to quietly, methodically change our government structures. And they have been very effective in the executive orders and other things. And I think a lot of that is being led by Pence very
quietly.
Did
I read that Gorsuch, maybe I'm wrong about this, was Pence's man? Yeah. I think I read that somewhere, but I may be wrong.
But I think we have to focus not so much on impeachment, but we have to focus on building up enough strength in the Congress through elections to beat them legislatively. And if impeachment comes, so be it. That's a Mueller thing. But
why does it have to be one or the other? I'm sorry, Teresa.
I just think people are hanging too much. There's just too much focus on impeachment when, in fact, the focus should be on a legislative strategy, winning in November, getting enough people to defeat them legislatively.
All right, one more letter and then we'll...
Okay, which is good, Joe, because that's what we got.
Excellent.
Hi, panel.
Hello.
Hello.
Bernie was able to cut across generations and political affiliations to get what should be the Democrats' message out in clear, simple, and accessible terms. Bernie laid out the roadmap, and the Dems would be foolish not to follow it, and that's from Barb. And Barb, I know that I'm going to just force my way in here because I know that Teresa will disagree and say, I agree with you. Bernie knew how to do that.
JP?
You want my opinion on Bernie? Well, I think Bernie's going to run in 2020. He's going to be phenomenal. I think he's going to run. He's right now the front runner. I think the Democrats would do better with Oprah than Bernie, but Bernie and Oprah, that's it. These other senators, Cuomo, Gillibrand, de Blasio, I don't see them even getting into the final round. But that's my opinion.
Well, I think that the message here is that Bernie, we've been talking all morning running around this thing about whether or not we can find somebody who can lay out the message. And so far, and everybody says, you go first. The truth is, Bernie knew how to do that.
A message, not the message.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the message, which is why I voted for him.
All right, we're going to pause there, and we are going to go to a news break. Ray Graff will be in here in just a moment. We'll be back. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 16th of January. Teresa Bourgeois is here. Alan Chartok, JP Miller. I'm Joe Donahue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and cue the letters. Here we go, Alan.
All right. Richard says, Trump is not a racist. Panel, Donald Trump is not a racist. He's an individual who behaves and makes statements that most people would reasonably associate with racial prejudice and injustice. People of goodwill who oppose prejudice and racial oppression should be wary and highly skeptical of this president, given his history. But like all of us, he is human and therefore capable, in capital letters, capable of change. Labeling somebody racist implies permanency and no possibility of change. Well, I'll start it by saying, yes, he is a racist. Right now, he's a racist. Whether or not he is capable of change, I think all people are capable of change. Although, as you may remember, Freud had his doubts about character being able to be changed. So I am, and I happen to subscribe to that theory, but I do think he's capable of seeing the light. But right now, I think there are lots of ways to prove that he is, in fact, a racist. So I reject Richard's letter. Is that simple enough?
I think that the racism charge, there is certainly a lot of evidence over his body of life's work to suggest that he has racist tendencies. I do think, though, that the charge of a president being a racist, I remember when Kanye West called George W. Bush a racist, I remember a lot of people on the right calling Obama a racist. It not only really puts a label on the person, but it also implies a little bit that those that voted for him are therefore racists. And his comments, he certainly brings this upon himself with his comments. But it's having the racism charge in our discussion is it hurts me to hear it and participate in it. That's all.
But what if it's true?
I don't think that this recent comment is obviously the first instance of evidence of him having tendencies like this.
I agree. Again, I ask the question then, so what if it's true?
If the body of evidence keeps mounting and mounting and mounting, one and one makes two.
The complex challenge, though, is it's such a distraction from the issues that we need to be talking about, and the, you know, sort of the weariness of this administration is that it's all about him, and it needs to be all about the country. We have some, you know, very serious opportunities and challenges, and yet we keep, you know, because of his behavior, the conversation keeps shifting to him as opposed to a national conversation about how to address these problems. And in the process, our standing globally has slipped away. In the process, the Republicans far right, you know, a very small percentage of the country, you know, their priorities are being put in place because he doesn't care about people attacking him. It helps him with his base, and it masks the conversation that we need to be having on all these issues.
But he's the leader of the country. We know that you can't get anywhere in the Congress without the guy. So if he is a racist, and if he develops...
knew that when he went down...
Oh, I'm sorry. I tried to let you finish.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
But if he is a racist, and his policies are racist, the very policies you're talking about and constantly talk about, it's very important for us to know that. You know, Woodrow Wilson...
So then let's talk about
KKK.
The implications of it as opposed to the fact of it.
I'm sorry.
Then let's have a conversation about the implications of it as opposed to the fact of it.
Oh, I don't know. You know, we spent a lot of time earlier today talking about keeping it simple and putting the message out there. We have Andrew Cuomo made a very good speech, a very good article in the New York Times. You know, I don't know what his motives were. It doesn't matter. He's right. You know, huge numbers of people in our prisons are black and Hispanic. We are not letting them out, even when the crimes that they have allegedly committed are of no importance relative to the major crimes. And yet they sit there and they rot. That is a part of a racist system, in my opinion. And I haven't heard this president going out and doing anything to oppose racist policies in this country. It's that simple.
So let's challenge him on the policies as opposed to, yeah. I mean,
well, but except if the things thinks from the head down.
All right, next letter.
Okay. Anyway, Leslie says, voice. We have a strong voice in the Senate. He was Al Franken, and he was thrown out under the bus by Kirsten Gillibrand to satisfy her own political aspirations. And by doing so, she became a foolish pawn of Roger Stone and the GOP doing their dirty work for them. I've lost all respect for her, says Leslie. I used to really, really like her, and that's from Leslie. Anybody?
I don't have any. I think Gillibrand is becoming a national figure in a big way in this conversation that we're all having on sexual harassment, and she's taking risks in doing that. Her raising her voice is not without risk, and her being called an opportunist, people don't become president of the United States without being a political opportunist. I see when you call Kirsten Gillibrand a political opportunist, in my mind, that is a compliment to her.
Teresa?
I think we just have to look to who replaced him, the senator, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on her name.
Former lieutenant governor.
Yes, the former lieutenant governor. And by all accounts, she's a very will be a very strong leader. I've been following on Twitter and other things, and that's why I'm annoyed with myself for blanking on her.
But you haven't addressed the Gillibrand comment at all.
I don't know how powerful Gillibrand's coming. I don't. You know, was it an opportunist move? Is she?
Well, but you're a voter in New York State. She's a senator from New York State. Do you feel that her forcing Franken out was
premature?
Was either premature or wrong?
I think that he was forced out because it was a political decision. It was a political move on her part and a political decision among the other Democrats that they felt they wanted to ensure that this was a safe seat. They feared it might be slipping away and that he might no longer be the best candidate to hold that seat. And they're trying to win back the Senate. And they made it not based on the Me Too issues, but based on a political decision. It was a political calculation.
VA wrote us, forget impeachment. It is a great mistake for Democrats to emphasize impeachment of Donald Trump for the 2018 election. This only strongly energizes the Republicans and their rhetoric for too long. Democratic political leaders seem unable to put across their agenda clearly enough to impress their voters. Democrats must forget impeachment, deliver a strong, cogent message if they want to win in November, and that's from Virginia. And let's see, the rest of the paper is blank, so I was hoping I would see what that message should be. Okay.
Tina Smith, by the way.
Thank you.
Oh, that's fine.
Tina Smith.
I've been reading about her and I completely lost her name. That was terrible.
Yeah. I think a simple Democratic message based on health care and tax cuts for the wealthy is going to deliver them a big victory in November. And having the Republican president in power with historically low approval ratings, if you look at history, the Democrats are in for a big positive wave into power in Congress this year.
And it's a basic security issue. It's economic security, health security, and national security. Do you feel more safe globally with Donald Trump in power and the Republicans? No, you don't. Look what happened in Hawaii. You know, people really believe that they could be the victims of a nuclear strike.
I hope you're right. I usually know it when I hear it, and I just didn't hear it. I think you're right. When you mention all of those things, you're on the target. But I think you have to be, you know, really simple about it. I happen to disagree with the writer and with JP. I think impeachment is on the table, and you should say, let's get rid of this guy, and let's elect this Congress to do exactly that, and you'll win the Congress.
I don't think it's good for Democrats or democracy to be talking about impeachment all the time.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's all the time, and I think we ought to be doing it a lot more than we're doing it.
Well, it's certainly an anti-Trump message, but I would side with Teresa that you don't want to really signal that ahead of when you get in. You want to wait till, okay, you're all sworn in on January 18th, and then maybe wait till January 31st before you start impeachment proceedings.
And I disagree with you, JP, for this reason. I think it's what will get you in.
Yeah, but what do you impeach him on?
Right.
As of right now, what do you impeach
exactly
him on?
Well,
somebody
right.
wrote a letter. Structure of justice, just like they did with Clinton.
We threw out Elliot Spitzer. Today we had a letter.
Yep.
We threw out Elliot Spitzer because he was indulging in prostitutes. Here's a guy who we know is doing the same sorts of thing.
Well, Spitzer resigned. He didn't get thrown out.
Well, you may be parsing it a little too closely. I think he was concerned that he would get thrown out. But I don't know. To this day, I still think Spitzer was a very good governor, and I'm not happy about it. And TJ.
Oh my goodness.
And TJ says, the most racist thing Trump has done is name Jefferson Beauregard Sessions Attorney General of the United States, and that's from TJ and Kerhonkson.
That's an interesting.
And. Dear panel, there seems to be some confusion on Trump's ability to tell the truth. In his mind, everything he says is true, and that any derogatory comments aimed at him in his mind are false, no matter what. A true narcissist. You guys are the best, Tom. No, you're the best, Tom.
Okay.
That's what I got.
I don't think there's any confusion about his assessment of his ability to tell the truth. I think it's really clear that he doesn't have a close affiliation with the truth. What are the implications of that? I mean, the implications of that is it's so hard to even cut a deal. How can you cut a deal with him on anything?
He is not good on the truth, but voters are very used to having lying politicians in
not
power.
This way.
That's a thing that's steeped into the voters. They're used to having lying politicians, and what he does is he chooses an enemy, which is the only entity that has less popularity than himself, and that is the media. The media has, I think, like 20% approval ratings or trust ratings, and so he beats up on the media constantly to discredit them, and he's chosen. I think that's a battle that he wins. That is something that helps him.
What's the cost of democracy in all of this?
He doesn't care about the cost of democracy. He doesn't care about what's good for the
country.
He cares about Trump.
On the contrary, he doesn't care about democracy. He's leading us in the other direction.
Right.
And let me just say, there are two things I'd like to ask. Number one, how come the stock market is up 263 points today? That's very interesting. I'm always in the dark about those things. And number two, is somebody planning to put a statue up to Dick Durbin for the kind of truth-telling that he's engaging in right now, and it can't be easy for him?
Well, if you watched Colbert last night, Chuck Schumer was on Stephen Colbert last night, and Chuck Schumer said, I was Dick Durbin's roommate for 20 years.
He was.
There is no more, whether you agree or with his politics or not, there's no more solid truth-telling guy in the United States Senate. And I thought that those words were really powerful on Colbert last night about Durbin's credibility.
Whether he actually is, I don't know, but he's certainly an Eagle Scout among senators in terms of, I don't know if he literally is, but he's certainly good to his word.
Okay, so I thought this was an interesting issue, and I wanted to bring it to the attention, which is we've been talking a lot in the past weeks about net neutrality. So now 50 senators have endorsed a legislative measure to override the Federal Communication Commission's recent decision to deregulate the broadband industry, that according to top Democrats, Chuck Schumer being one of them. The tally leaves supporters just one Republican vote shy of the 51 required to pass a Senate resolution of disapproval in a legislative gambit aimed at restoring the agency's net neutrality rules. Those rules, which banned internet providers from blocking or slowing down websites, were swept away in a December vote led by Republican FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. Is that correct?
Ajit Pai, yeah.
Ajit Pai, thank you. Republicans have argued that the rules were too restrictive for industry, while Democrats said they provided a vital consumer protection. Will they find the vote? A lot of silence. Okay.
Well, let's look at it this way. They should find the vote, and here's why. You know, politicians are very well known for putting some spit on their finger and holding it up in the air to see which way the wind is blowing. The wind is blowing. Do you want the big corporations controlling your internet? Or do you want, a fair game where everybody gets equal treatment on the internet. That's really what it comes down to. Now, you know, there are a lot of things that, for want of a better word, fat cat Republicans, for example, might want to defend. When you come down to banks and you want to come down to other things where the money comes in and the rest. I'm telling you, this is a sleeping giant, and this could hurt people. So I don't think it should be that hard to pick up that one. And once they pick up that one, they'll get a lot more than one.
Now, they got Susan Collins already, so it's the other one. And who will that be?
Flake, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think on this one, the political forces are such that they might be able to get these extra votes.
Now, how does it actually work? So can anybody, because you're the Senate expert in the room, Teresa, can anybody just stand up and call for such a vote, or does their leadership have to approve calling for the vote?
Well, the leadership has to bring the bill to the floor, but if you have overwhelming support for it, you signal overwhelming support.
So it's not one vote. It's more than one vote.
Right.
Well, I think this is one that the politicians are scared about because so many Americans now get their television from Netflix and from Amazon.com and all these internet-based providers that if all of a sudden the voters, you know, you get a little delay on your Netflix or you get an increase in your Netflix bill, that is something, you know, you see how the cable companies are viewed around the country. That's something that the senators do not want to have to wear on their sleeves.
All right, we'll see what happens with that and
banking.
Let's go to banking. Absolutely, we'll talk about the banking rules and Democrats add momentum to GOP push to loosen the banking rules. We only have about 2 minutes left, so we'll talk about this quickly. But the most significant attempt to loosen rules imposed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis is underway in Congress, as the Senate. My screen just went out. I'm sorry.
Let me put it this way, Joe. Before we go any further, money talks, all others walk. And the bankers have an awful lot of money to spread around. That is for sure. You know, when we had this big blow up just a few short years ago, and everybody swore we were going to keep control of these guys and watch what they were doing, it became a very popular subject. But in the meantime, the rats are coming out of the K Street lobbying offices, and they are landing, and Democrats are not immune.
The key to this agreement is that they're focusing on the small to mid-sized banks, and they're trying to loosen the Dodd-Frank rules around the small and mid-sized banks. And also around mortgage lending. And it looks like they may get a deal. I'm wondering, I don't know anything about the markets, but I'm wondering if that's what's helping to lift
the
markets.
Oh, that could be, Teresa.
Because these, you have the combination of the tax bill that gave a real green light to the big banks, and now if you can loosen the Dodd-Frank regulations around the small banks, in some cases you need to around the community lending banks, but in others I worry about this. But that could be, again, that's total speculation. I don't understand the markets, but it could be what's driving the markets.
Combination.
Okay, we'll pause there. Thank you very much, everybody. Teresa, JP, Alan, thank you. We'll be back.
Let's remember that lockbox. It's so important. Think with your heart. Think with your heart and what this radio station represents to you.